This is great. Did anybody bring their own writing? I made an invitation at dinner for people who might have their own writing to bring, and I know people might be shy, or maybe you don't want to raise your hand, or maybe you'll change your mind about whether you brought something or not. The end. That's fine. I say it partly because we had this really wonderful little session on Friday of last week. We had been talking about incarnation in American literature last week, and I sort of gave these little assignments that I wasn't sure anybody would actually follow based on what we were talking about each day, and a couple of people actually did, writing about very different things, but one of them was a friend of mine that had no idea she was a writer, and she wrote something right before the session and came in with it sort of longhand in a notebook, and I don't think she was sure she was going to read about it. But it was something that she had mentioned. I said, oh, everybody's got stories about something. And she said something about an experience that she'd had. And I said, oh, that sounds like a story. You should write that sometime. I had no idea that she was going to actually bring this up because she's sort of retiring. She very rarely says anything in the sessions, even though she comes to all of them. And somebody else read something in the back, and then somebody else read something. And then here comes my friend with this thing that she had just written. And it was great. And I was shocked. Not because, you know, she's very smart. Woman, but I had no idea she was going to bring anything that day, and it was really kind of a wonderful little revelation. It was a great piece, and so if anybody has anything like that, or maybe that's setting the bar too high, set the bar nice and low. It doesn't have to be a prophetic word, but one of the things that creative writing can do, and we have talked about this a little bit this week in earlier sessions, is that it can open up possibilities. Poetic language, and by that we mean also certain kinds of prose, because they're new, can remind us that the world that we live in is changing and can change for the better. And that's part of God's story about this planet. So when you do that kind of writing, I think you also are doing something that's a little bit prophetic, even if it doesn't seem like it's a religious topic. If you can remind people that the realities that they were born into are not necessarily going to stand for all time, I think that that's part of what God's message is for us, the God who says that he will make all things new, and that in Christ there is a new creation, and that we can be new every morning. That sort of language is also one of the things that creative language does almost automatically. It's one of the reasons we call it creative. It's not like reading the phone book. It's new. So if you have that kind of thing, anything, and it can be nonfiction, it can be fiction, it can be poetry or not poetry, I don't care. If you have something you'd like to read, or even maybe I'll ask if we have time at the end, if you've got a story that you haven't written that you feel like needs to be told, poetry that hasn't yet been penned, this might be a time to talk a little bit about that too, because I really do feel like we may all be called to be prophetic writers. And one of the things that Walter Brueggemann's book does is open up that category of the prophetic, which is a little bit of what we talked about earlier in the week. Today's session is called, let me get this right, God's Garage. Is that right? Did I actually say that? Yes, God's Garage. And the hope of a holy surprise? That sounds right? Yeah. This is a chance to sort of encapsulate some of the ideas that Walter Brueggemann is working with in his book, The Prophetic Imagination, which is, as I've said many times, available in the bookstore. And you can pick up a copy. It's a short book. It's a little classic. And it opens up all sorts of interesting ways of reading scripture. But it also opens up some ways of seeing the world and maybe some ways of seeing American writing that we've talked about up until this point. If you were going to encapsulate one of the problems that Brueggemann sees in contemporary society and also in the biblical tradition in as much as it reflects a certain kind of theology, which often the prophets are arguing against, which is based on the notion that Jerusalem was a holy city where God sort of lived and which could never be overcome. Now, of course, if you read the prophetic literature in the Old Testament, Jerusalem is getting overcome several times. You have a couple of different exiles. And so that isn't actually the historical experience of Israel, but there's still remnants of that idea that Jerusalem was a place that could never be overcome as long as you had God's holy temple there. And prophets like Jeremiah are looking around them and saying, that's not going to be true. Okay, whatever God is, it's not that. But one of the interesting things about the fact that you have these two strains within the biblical record is I think what we have there is also something that's very revealing about what we want to do with religion. And if you think about it, in the quickest way to show you this is what I put on the board, which is this. a week or two ago, we had a session where we were thinking about names, and we were thinking about that name God. What do we mean by God? What sorts of things do we end up associating with a word like God? How many of those are biblical? How many of those are just pulling out of the air? How true is that language? What does it mean to say that God is love? What does that mean? Words ultimately are inadequate to express that kind of reality. Here we have the word God, and we've got it in a box. And in a sense, this is sort of what Brueggemann is complaining about. And he sees it in the biblical literature. He sees it in the Royal Jerusalemite theology that King Solomon sort of institutes when he builds the temple. And he sees it also in, I think, just the general way that human beings approach their religion, that there is this overriding tendency to put God in a box. And the way that the reason I was thinking about God's garage is a sort of metaphor of thinking about where Brueggemann gets this, is that in a sense, for him, when he looks at Solomon, from one perspective, you could say, well, what did Solomon do? Well, maybe he was protecting or building or celebrating the house of God. And Brueggemann is going to say, no, he built a garage for God. He had his palace, and there was a little annex, and that's where God was. And if you wanted to get into the garage, you had to have a key, or you had to go through the palace. There's a sense in which that what seems like a celebration of God ends up becoming a kind of control of God, and that's part of what Solomon was about. But I think that potentially is also sort of what we can be about, and it's one of the real temptations that I think we have to struggle against as Christians. And it's also one of the real frustrations that certain writers have had with American religion. I think both religious and irreligious writers can look around them and see all sorts of different forms of religious hypocrisy and see all of the ways that power subverts the language of religion and think, well, this is just about putting God in a box, taking this wonderful transcendent possibility and boxing it up in a way that makes it easier to control. That, at least, is one of the criticisms that I think we're going to find when we look at Mark Twain's work in just a little bit. If we're thinking about this, though, just in terms of our own lives, I'm sort of curious whether this is language that resonates for you. And here we're jumping off of Brueggemann and sort of saying, well, where's the relevance of this for us, before we look at the literature even? Is this a temptation that we can relate to, this notion that you're going to put God in a box? And if so, what sort of boxes do we use for God? Maybe this is time for a confessional where you can say something very personal. You know, when you talk about your personal demons, what are your personal boxes? Where are the places that you hold in your mind or heart where God sort of fits? Anybody?
Something we're comfortable with.
Something we're comfortable with. Like?
Well, I've been in programs where God has been referred to, this has been an acronym for either the great outdoors, this is when I was in Colorado, or good orderly direction.
And
I'm embarrassed to say that as a teacher, I try to not use it as an acronym for what's required of a paper, which is to say grammar, organization, and details.
Yes.
So I put those three on the board in a different order.
Yes.
But it's curious to me that that's what it is.
Order. Is that right? Grammar, order, details?
Yeah.
And this is for a paper.
But in general, good orderly direction keeps coming back. I hear that a lot.
Yeah. What about the rest of this? Is this one of the things that we find when we go to look for God? This idea that it's in order and direction and maybe some church services are more like this than others. Maybe everybody being at Holden is a sign that it's something else that we need to look at. Other boxes for God?
Clarity, unambiguous.
Unambiguous. Clarity.
Certainty, absolute.
Ah, yeah. I think that's one of mine, probably, too. Yeah. We crave.
It's much easier to say what other people do about putting God in a box.
Okay.
You are so those people, you know, it's all about anti-abortion or pro-life or whatever, or it's all about, you know, seeing God on these particular issues, and they have God in a box.
Yes.
And it's
much
harder to see our own boxes.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for bringing that up. I asked the question the wrong way. I do this all the time. I make this mistake in class many, many times, and I always have to change it, and I have to say, how many people think that 9 out of 10 Christians put God in a box?
And we're the one that doesn't.
We're just the ones that don't, right? Right. Maybe that's fair. We can't really see ourselves. Okay, well, let's go to that then. 9 out of 10 Christians? What sort of box? We had this idea of, did you mention abortion as sort of being an issue that can do that for people?
Yeah.
Okay. Other boxes that you see out there in American Christianity where God gets put?
Control.
Control.
Patriotism.
Patriotism.
Church.
Church. Boy, is that weird. How is that even possible?
God is what they access for an hour on Sunday morning, and then they go do what they're going to do.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, we got God.
They make their pet God at church, in the church building, and then they walk out the door, and they're still, and I don't want to use a bad word, but I'll.
Okay, yeah. Set aside that little hour, and that's a nice little discreet box for God. I got to say, sometimes I've been guilty of that.
Denominationalism does that.
Denominationalism. God is a Lutheran, right? I'm pretty sure he is.
He.
Whoa! What did I just say? Yeah. Whoops. It is. That was one. Boy, we've gotten more conscious about that, but I still slip into it all the time. That's what I was growing. That's what I grew up with. And maybe that'll change for the next generation, or maybe it won't, but you're probably right. That's also a box for God. Somebody said comfort is, I think, right away being one of the things that led us maybe to make these boxes. And I think that's true, isn't it? There's something awfully comfortable about a God in a box. Right? Put it right under your bed at night. You got nothing to worry about. You pull it out in the morning. Say your prayers. Right? Other boxes?
Christianity. I mean, besides denominationalism, it's wider than that.
Christianity. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Is God bigger than that?
American civil religion.
Ah, yeah. This goes beyond patriotism. Anybody heard this term before, civil religion? It used to be coin of the realm. Lots of people sort of knew about it. And then for a while it was kind of passe, and recently it's come back. People are thinking about it again. Sort of like patriotism, but a certain kind, the kind of spiritual element. Yeah. Box for God.
Link language.
Language.
Yeah, because we're limited in how we can try to describe God. And different languages.
Yeah.
You know, do it differently.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was sitting next to...
Merrick? Is that right?
At Vespers last night, I don't know. Hispanic woman who doesn't know any of our songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because she sings in Spanish when she worships.
Sure.
So we were limiting by our language.
Yeah, yeah. Tom and Mary were here doing a lot with music. Were you here for some of that? We did a lot of music last week in other languages. And part of that is sort of to remind us the boxes that we might not be conscious of. Because I love the old hymns. I love the hymns that I learned when I was a child that I still remember. It's wonderful to have those. But maybe because they're comfortable, they're also a little bit dangerous. If I make the mistake of thinking that that's Christianity. That's a real hymn. Do you sometimes think that when you leave church? Oh, yeah, that's what the real music... And then they try something new, right? The new pastor comes in and says, we're going to sing this, and you count. Oh. Ashes in the mouth, right? You're sort of reading this new hymn and thinking, oh, it's not familiar, it's not the same, it's not that good. Maybe it isn't that good. It might not be as good as the old standards, poetically, objectively, but isn't it a good thing that we're challenged? Isn't it a good thing that we sometimes are forced to sort of say, yeah, I'm a little too comfortable with some of those old hymns, wonderful as they might be. So, this is God in the box. And part of what I'm wondering about is if we can think about these boxes as part of how we understand judgment. I've been struck by something that a staff person here said a couple of days ago in one of Fred's talks, where she asked the very simple question that I think every Christian asks when they read those judgmental passages in Scripture. Why? Why is God the destroyer of cities? Right? Why does God do these things that seem really impossible to understand? And I have a terrible time with these passages. I usually skirt over them. I don't like to think about them. I like to pretend that they're not actually in the Bible. And when I talk about what a wonderful thing Scripture is, usually those aren't the parts that I'm thinking of. I'm willfully excluding them from the picture. And I don't know what to make of that. But one of the ways that I've been thinking about judgment this week, and you can tell me whether you think this is part of what we, maybe it's helpful, is that it's partly about destroying boxes. That in those prophetic moments, whether they're at the point where a city is being destroyed or whether they're a little bit before, the prophetic word is coming in to take away a box or to make people recognize that a box is what they have. You think you have a temple, you've got a box. God is bigger than that. And if it takes destroying the city to show you that, that's what's going to happen. Now, I don't know if that helps us with the horrors of the sort of thing that happened to the Israelites in the exile, but it at least gives me a little bit more sense of where God might be coming from. Is it possible that we can get to a point where... That's all it is. It's just a box. The box is God. We don't even need the language of God anymore. There's a reference in Jeremiah to cracked pots that don't hold water. They were made to hold water, but they can't even hold water anymore, and all you've got is a cracked pot. Right? Is there a possibility that this is where we could end up? If God lets us live in a box, or have him in a box, for too long. At least maybe that's a possibility. I may have a chance. I had a vision. It wasn't a prophetic vision, or maybe it wasn't. One of the interesting things that I've gotten from Fred this week is this notion that some of the prophets sort of decide about whether or not they've had a prophetic vision after the fact. We had that story today about the field in Jeremiah, right? And the Lord says, your cousin's going to come and sell you a field. And Jeremiah says, hum, hum, hum. And then the cousin shows up and tries to sell him a field and says, ah, right? Now I know. So maybe this is a vision in retrospect. But I had an image in my head this morning, sort of before I was awake, of Jesus standing on the ashes of a city and welcoming me home with the open arms that Paul was sort of talking about in Vespers last night when he was saying this is the invitation to dance, right? And I thought maybe that for me is a way to sort of reconcile this notion of judgment, that God is going to be found on the ashes of my cities, my boxes, welcoming me home. That's sort of my hope. And partly because we're going to look at, I think, a really dark piece right now, this piece from Mark Twain. Maybe that's worth remembering. That there, at least in the biblical literature, is the hope of a return. And at the end of this session, I think we'll probably reread that little passage that Fred gave us this morning from Jeremiah. Rachel weeping and then the promise of a return, just to remind ourselves of the hope that's out there, as well as the judgment. But maybe could we, let's take a look at the Mark Twain piece.
Does everybody have it?
Everybody have the war prayer? How many people? I guess Josh has a couple of them. Don't worry about the Sula piece here. This is this one that says 1919 is nothing you have to worry about. It's part of Sula. If you're interested in this kind of language, you might want to pick it up. It's in the bookstore. But we're not actually talking about it today. And I'm guessing that maybe we haven't had a chance to read this. Anybody read this already? A couple of people? Okay. I think we better, let's go ahead and read it aloud just since it's fairly short. And what you're going to see is there's a sort of movement. There, it starts with one picture, and then a character comes in the middle and gives another kind of picture, and then there's a kind of irresolution resolution at the end. As you're listening, though, listen a bit for boxes, because maybe that's where we'll start. So this is Mark Twain's The War Prayer. Does somebody want to read the first paragraph? Somebody with a booming voice? Or maybe just a clear voice. Thanks.
It was a time of great and exalting excitement. The country was up in arms, the war was on, and every breast burned a holy fire of patriotism. The drums were beating, the bands playing, the toy pistols popping, the bunched firecrackers hissing and spluttering. On every hand and far down the receding and fading spread of roofs and balconies, a fluttering wilderness of flags flashed in the sun. Daily, the young volunteers marched down the wide avenue, gay and fine in their new uniforms, the proud fathers and mothers and sisters and sweethearts cheering them with voices choked with happy emotions as they swung by. Nightly, the packed mass meetings listened, panting, to patriot oratory which stirred the deepest deeps of their hearts, in which they interrupted at briefest intervals with cyclones of applause, the tears running down their cheeks the while. In the churches, the pastors preached devotion to flag and country and invoked the God of battles, beseeching his aid in our good cause, an outpouring of fervid eloquence which moved every listener. It was indeed a glad and gracious time, and the half-dozen rash spirits that ventured to disapprove of the war, and cast a doubt upon its righteousness straight away, got such a stern and angry warning that for their personal safety's sake, they quickly shrank out of sight and offended no more in that way.
Somebody want to take it up from there?
Sunday morning came. Next day, the battalions would leave for the front. The church was filled. The volunteers were there, their young faces alight with martial dreams, visions of the stern advance, the gathering momentum, the rushing charge, the flashing sabers, the flight of the foe, the tumult, the enveloping smoke, the fierce pursuit, the surrender. Then home from the war, bronze heroes, welcomed, adored, submerged in golden seas of glory. With the volunteers sat their dear ones, proud, happy, and envied by the neighbors and friends who had no sons and brothers to send forth to the field of honor, there to win for the flag, or failing, die the noblest of noble deaths. The service proceeded. A war chapter from the Old Testament was read. The first prayer was said. It was followed by an organ burst that shook the building, and with one impulse the house rose, with glowing eyes and beating hearts, and poured out the tremendous invocation, God the All-Terrible, thou who ordainest thunder thy clarion and lightning thy sword. Then came the long prayer. None could remember the like of it, for passionate pleading and moving and beautiful language. The burden of its supplication was that an ever merciful and benignant Father of us all would watch over our noble young soldiers and aid, comfort, and encourage them in their patriotic work. Bless them, shield them in the day of battle and the hour of peril. Bear them in his mighty hand. Make them strong and confident, invincible in the bloody onset. Help them to crush the foe. Grant to them and to their flag and country imperishable honor and glory.
Okay. And here we're going to have a transition. Does somebody want to pick this up?
An aged stranger entered and moved a slow and noiseless step up to the main aisle, his eyes fixed upon the minister, his long body clothed in a robe that reached to his feet, his head bare, his white hair descending in a frothy cataract to his shoulders, his seamy face unnaturally pale, pale even to ghastliness. With all eyes following him and wondering, he made his silent way. Without pausing, he ascended to the preacher's side and stood there, waiting. With shut lids, the preacher, unconscious of his presence, continued his moving prayer and at last finished it with the words uttered in fervent appeal, Bless our arms, grant us the victory, O Lord our God, Father and protector of our land and flag.
The stranger touched his arm, motioned him to step aside, which the startled minister did, and took his place. During some moments, he surveyed the spellbound audience with solemn eyes, in which burned an uncanny light. Then, in a deep voice, he said, we should find somebody with a deeper voice than mine. Can somebody give it a read? We don't, no baritones or basses out there? Thanks.
I come from the throne, bearing a message from Almighty God. The words smote the house with a shock. The stranger perceived it, he gave no attention. He has heard the prayer of his servant, your shepherd, and will grant it if such shall be your desire, after I, his messenger, shall have explained to you its import, that is to say, its full import. For it is like unto many of the prayers of men, in that it asks for more than he who utters it is aware of, except he pause and think.
Continue, if you don't mind.
God's servant and yours has prayed his prayer. Has he paused and taken thought? Is it one prayer? No, it is two. One uttered, the other not. Both have reached the ear of him who heareth all supplications, the spoken and the unspoken. Ponder this, keep it in mind. If you would beseech a blessing upon yourself, beware, lest without intent you invoke a curse upon a neighbor at the same time. If you pray for the blessing of rain upon your crop, which needs it, by that act you are possibly praying for a curse upon some neighbor's crop, which may not need rain and can be injured by it. You have heard your servant's prayer and the uttered part of it. I am commissioned of God to put into words the other part of it, that part which the pastor and also you in your hearts fervently prayed silently and ignorantly and unthinkingly. God grant that it was so. You heard these words, grant us the victory, O Lord our God. That is sufficient. The whole of the uttered prayer is compact into those pregnant words. Elaborations were not necessary. When you have prayed for victory, you have prayed for many unmentioned results which follow victory, must follow it, cannot help but follow it. Upon the listening spirit of God the Father fell also the unspoken part of the prayer. He commandeth me to put it into words. Listen. O Lord, our Father, our young patriots, idols of our hearts, go forth to battle. Be thou near them, with them, in spirit. We also go forth from the sweet peace of our beloved firesides to smite the foe. O Lord our God, help us tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us cover their smiling fields with pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with the shrieks of their wounded, writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Help us to turn them out ruthless with their little children to wander unfriended the wastes of their desolated land in rags of hunger and thirst. Sports of the sun flames of summer and the icy winds of winter, broken in spirit, worn with travail, imploring thee for the refuge of the grave and denied it. For our sakes, who adore thee, Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protract their bitter pilgrimage, make heavy their steps, water their way with their tears, stain the white snow with the blood of their wounded feet. We ask it in the spirit of love, of him who is the source of love, and who is the ever-faithful refuge and friend of all that are sore beset and seek his aid with humble and contrite hearts. Amen. After a pause. Ye have prayed it. If ye still desire it, speak. The messenger of the Most High waits. It was believed afterward that the man was a lunatic, and because there was no sense in what he said.
Thank you. Thank you, readers, all of you. So as you were reading, I started marking and then I gave up. Were you seeing boxes for God, especially in the first part? What sorts of boxes is Mark Twain sort of looking at here, drawing out into the sunlight? Do you notice some there?
Well, yeah? God is on our side, whatever that means.
Our? Okay.
Our side.
Glory.
Glory? The glory of battle? Glory? Other places, boxes for God?
Our land.
Our land, that vision of a land, which is always being defended.
Victory.
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 That sort of sums it all up. What's being prayed for? Victory.
Our flag and country.
Flag. Our flag. Not theirs. Any more?
Insiders and outsiders.
Insiders and outsiders?
Yeah, like, this is an insider's... it's our side versus their side.
Hmm.
It's language about being inside of an understanding of, I don't know, inside of, tough to say, standing on a soapbox of God here. I mean, that's the view that you get, but you get one side of the argument, I guess.
Yeah, we could almost think of this as a church or a congregation, being a box.
The either or versus a both and, you know, even the angel himself or the messenger is saying a blessing for you equals a curse for the neighbor, versus the possibility of blessings for all. In the argument he's making, it makes sense, but it's still a box.
Yeah.
God is an either or.
Right.
Mechanism.
Yeah. Yeah. That may be true. God, in this picture that Twain is giving us, is sort of trapped. If he answers one side of the prayer, he's going to end up cursing the other side. Right? He's got only one alternative. Yes or no? He's also putting the congregation in that position, partly because he thinks they're already there, but they're just not admitting it. Okay? They sort of know it, but they maybe aren't saying it out loud. The unspoken prayer that hopefully they're ignorant of. Maybe not. Maybe they do know. What do you think? Is the picture of war that we get in that little paragraph, which is so awful, is it one of the things that we consider as a country when we're thinking about whether or not we're going to go to a war, whether or not to pray for victory? Do you think we're conscious of it? Yeah.
The specifics of that paragraph, in my mind, go so strongly against what he calls, what the preacher of the church calls the good cause. And this is the cause, all of these specific images that are so horrible.
Yeah, yeah. Those probably weren't the words that the preacher was using. Remember, it says he's using eloquent language?
Yeah.
We could probably put that down here as another box for God. All that beautiful speech. Such a good prayer.
Well, he couldn't even remember the words. They were so abstract and eloquent.
Yes, eloquent, yeah.
You mentioned about, are we aware of it? I think, thinking of Iraq, Afghanistan, I think our government has learned the lesson of Vietnam, as they said, where during the Vietnam War we saw actual battle footage every night on the television. In these wars, that's not allowed, specifically, even to showing caskets of American dead coming home.
Sure.
So I think there's an effort to shield us so that we don't see that part of it.
Yes. I think that's probably true. Does that necessarily mean that we don't know it's happening? Because I know what you're saying about television. Television's a powerful tool, but so is imagination.
I don't know. The graphic picture of Vietnam was that small girl fleeing
yes.
the village
yes.
after having the napalm.
Sure.
And that horrified America when they saw that picture because it was so graphic.
Yep.
So I don't know that people's imagination takes them there because perhaps they don't want to go there.
Okay. Yeah.
I think they deliberately direct. And this guy does too. The imagination in a different place, and the flags are waving. And you know, I don't remember them all now, but flags waving, people shouting, the badges of victory on their uniforms, and all of that stuff. And we've done that in our wars as well.
Yes.
The specifics of patriotism are where we direct our minds are directed, not to the specifics of the horrors of war.
I mean, so we watch the parade?
We watch the parades. I mean,
okay.
I think I put the rest of the images are there in the first paragraph.
Okay.
A wilderness of flags, the holy fire patriotism, the drums are beating, bands are playing, all that stuff.
Yeah.
That drowns out the images of the
it's on the other side, yeah. Yeah. I always think, I mentioned before, I teach some classes on war memory, and one of the things that Twain doesn't really talk about in here that I think is maybe an important omission is what happens to the soldiers that are on our side. And this is a story that sometimes isn't always told, but a lot of the people who do see some of the most horrible horrors of war are the ones who are most reluctant to say much about it. And sometimes they can't. And of course, the people who suffer the most, the ultimate cost, right, don't get to talk at all. And this creates a huge problem for the rest of us. I hope many people still consider themselves patriots. I think there's a lot to be patriotic about, but how do you speak for some of that suffering if you're one of the ones who's left behind? Sometimes that's a huge burden. The question here, instead of necessarily just thinking about war as being the subject, is to think a little bit about this also as religion, and also this problem of making boxes for our God. I'm really curious what you think about the last line. This is one that's always a little puzzling to me. Why do you think that Twain says that the people don't understand what's been told to them?
I don't think they want to understand. They'd rather call it a lunatic than have to look at, after all this hoopla, to really look at the reality of it so they decide they have to dismiss it as crazy because of their prejudice and their glasses that they're viewing this through.
Okay.
I think you get that when they talk about the people who were disapproving of the war spoke out, and it was made very clear to them, you better shut up or you're going to be in big trouble hanging from the post. And that where they shrank out of sight and offended no more in that way.
Yeah. I actually underlined that when I was underlining things about boxes. I don't know if that was right. Was that right? Out of personal safety, you shrink from telling the truth?
I have a friend that I met at Holden 13 years ago who was out of his first call because of the 4th of July sermon.
Wow. Wow. So there are consequences, yeah. Out of his first call, yeah.
Who speaks the word of God, the preacher or the outside stranger that shows up?
Well, what do you think? I think it's really interesting that they don't listen to him, that they think he's a lunatic. Because part of what he says seems just so obvious. Right? If you're praying for victory, sort of, that is what you're praying for. So what's so impossible to understand? You said we don't want it to be true. What if it is? What if we were to admit that the stranger was right? What would that call us to?
Repentance.
Repentance?
Changing our direction.
Okay.
Not necessarily.
No? You don't think so?
Absolutely not.
Okay, why? Yeah.
Depends if you believe in a justifiable war.
What's that?
Depends on what you, if you believe that there could ever be a justifiable war.
Right. Right.
If they're going off to fight Nazi Germany. My father went off and died. He still has horrible memories and everything. It was a terrible price he paid. He lived. He knew people that didn't.
Sure.
He killed people.
Sure.
It was awful.
Yeah.
Was it the right thing to do? Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then their cause isn't a good cause anymore. I don't know why this happened to me, but just as everybody was reading this, what flashed in my mind was the Matthew Shepard story, that kid that was taken out and strung to a fence post and left to die, beat up and then left to die. Somebody had to be so certain about their way of life and their religious beliefs that they could do that to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to give up that certainty.
Wow.
And so this that now my phrase comes, now I get why that flashed in front of me. That was their good cause. And I don't want to let that change my whole paradigm, doesn't it?
I think so. That idea of certainty. The box has squares. It's stable. You build your life on it. What happens when the servant of the Most High comes down and says, hold on a second. Let me tell you about the box that you're standing on. There are two sides to a story. And I think this notion of the possibility of a just war is one that we need to keep in mind. We also have to remember we that idea of war, like the word God. How do we define it? If we define it as parades, isn't that a problem? Even if it's a just war, right? If we don't see the other side of it. But it's really interesting to me that it's possible that God could come down himself in this form, walk into a church and say, here's what you're asking. And not only wouldn't they make the decision to pray it or not to pray it, they would just say, I don't even know what this guy's talking about, right? That's not a choice that I have to make. There's something so unreal about that, and yet it feels sort of true to me. It's a lot like my life. I get attached to these things. I don't want to give them up. I like my little certainties. I don't know if I'm ready to hear that message from outside. Interesting piece. Maybe we could look at one other. This is the much more comic tale of Raleigh Hayes. And I don't think we'll have time to read the whole thing. I hope you read it at some point. But maybe we could look at a couple of little pieces here. Everybody got that? One of the interesting things about this book is that it's pretty overtly religious. You have the prologue, which, as I mentioned, if you want to look up Job, maybe we should just look at Job very quickly. I have a hard time finding Job. Here he is. So chapter Job starts, there was once a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all people of the East. His sons used to go and hold feasts in one another's houses in turn, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when feast days had run their course, Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This is what Job always did. Verse 6, one day the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan was also among them. And those of us who know Job know what happens, right? It's this almost bewildering tale of hardship that's heaped upon this poor righteous man, Job, to test his faith. Something similar happens in this book in the prologue. If you look at that little piece, the first book of this book, it's separated into 3, is called The Call. Okay? Which is a little like a prophetic call. And then the prologue says, there lived in the Piedmont of North Carolina a decent citizen and responsible family man named Raleigh Whittier Hayes, who obeyed the law and tried to do the right thing. He had a wife and 2 daughters. He owned his own house, his own business, 2 oceanfront rental properties, 2 automobiles, his own retirement plan, and a large number of treasury bonds. Thus, was he well established in the middle class. Also, he took care to be a member of the Civitans, the Chamber of Commerce, the Baptist Church, the Neighborhood Association, and the United Fund. Everyone who knew him called him Reliable Raleigh, Hardworking Raleigh, Fair and Square Raleigh, and in general, Respectable, Smart, Steady, Honest, Punctual, Decent, Raleigh Hayes. The day came when the members of the court ahead and took their places in the presence of the Lord. And you can imagine what's going to happen. His life is going to be turned upside down. And this is the sort of fun of this book. It happens, it starts with this sort of crazy sort of scene where they're in a Chinese restaurant and they get these fortune cookies that all have malicious little fortunes put in them. And Raleigh's, of course, is, I think I put this, yes, everybody got this fortune at lunch over here. Where is Raleigh's? You will go completely to pieces by the end of the month. And Raleigh's response to this, if you see on page 4, is obviously nothing could be more preposterous. He's that kind of guy, right? Mr. Hayes knew himself to be an irrevocably sane man, nor was this conclusion reached in a vacuum. He had a great many blood relations who were not in one piece, and he could see the difference. Folding the nonsensical strip, he put it absentmindedly in his pocket. Raleigh's got a lot of relatives who are very different from him, and that's one of the things you find out as you read that first chapter. His father is one of them. His father is one of the characters who's sort of impossible. He's an ex-reverend, okay? That's the kind of guy his father is. He's the kind of father who takes 3 wives. Raleigh's mother is the second, okay? He's the kind of father who, partway through this first chapter, it turns out, has gone in at his son's behest to have medical tests. His son is a life insurance salesman and worries a lot about making sure to dot all the I's and cross all the T's, so he has his father go in to be tested, and his father takes off. Buys a $20,000 convertible Cadillac, grabs an African-American teenager, and takes off with about $50,000 out of the bank, which is money that Raleigh is going to inherit. Okay? This is why it's a story of Job, right? This is the kind of oppression that this character is going to go through. But one of the things that you'll find as you read this, and you can probably already guess what's going to happen, is that this is also a story of redemption. If you look at the very end of this first chapter, and we'll look at some other places too, but you can see at the very end, he gets another fortune, having gone back to the Chinese restaurant. This one is from, apparently, a regular fortune cookie. They fixed the fortune cookie problem for the time being, perhaps. It says, this is your lucky day. Okay. And between those two fortunes, we have a really, really wonderful tale. It's really funny. It's redemptive. It's very much religious. It's about sin and grace. And so I would recommend to anybody who hasn't read this book to go ahead and read it. It's one of the few really, really funny books that I've read, I think, in the last 10 years. And a favorite of some people that I really like a lot. So I think you'll like it if you read it. But it also gets us to think a little bit about this character, Raleigh Hayes. And you have a little bit of a sense of who he is, just based on that little prologue where it sort of says he's got all of these qualities. Let me give you another one. On page 8. Raleigh is leaving the Chinese restaurant, and it gives us this little description of where he is. Raleigh Hayes always walked fast, even if he was only walking to the bathroom, even if he was only walking along the beach. He hurried because 45 years had already gotten away from him, because life was always 2 uncatchable steps in front of him, running away like a burglar. Wait, you're laughing because?
That's it.
We're going to come back to you because I want to know what you're laughing at. Running away like a burglar with satchels full of all the things that should have belonged to Raleigh Hayes, like money, position, a home in which nothing was unrepaired, and in general a future, and mostly his just desserts. What our hero didn't know as he hurried back to business was that the burglar was just now getting ready to wheel around and scare him to death by flinging the satchels at his head. That, at any rate, was his father's plan, if a man like his father could be said to have formulated anything that could reasonably call itself a plan, which Raleigh would have denied. Okay, so we have a little sketch of his character there. And I'm a little curious about how much this sounds like us, this little description. I really like the idea of time. Sort of always 2 steps ahead like a burglar. The things that you should have. Does it feel like that? Those of us who are, well, I'm under 45. I feel like that sometimes. Maybe some of you who are older than 45 feel like that sometimes. Things that you should have had that you wanted to run after. It's an understandable response in a lot of ways. And in many ways, Raleigh Hayes is a good man. Does he have any flaws? We've heard a lot of wonderful characteristics. Does he have any flaws that you can see from what you've read or skimmed? What in the world could God be doing judging this righteous man if that's what's going to happen?
Well, he had a really narrow vision of life. He didn't look any to the side at all.
You get the sense that he's...
He's got a box.
Yeah.
He said he liked living in.
A box. Based on what? Again, I'm asking you to do a lot of work with a limited description, I realize, but I think we're catching on, aren't we? Don't we have a sense? We know people like this. Wait a minute. I'm something like this.
With nothing that needs repair. And neat and order and tidy and...
Yeah.
And controlled and...
What's wrong with
he always
comes. Aspires to that. We don't have it.
Yeah.
There's something that keeps you on the edge when you don't have it.
I'm going to tower that one
here. Yeah. I lived in a house like this.
Well, he knows he deserves it, too.
Ah, okay.
Just desserts.
Just desserts, yeah. Especially, that's what he's running after. What do you think that means?
Well, he figures he's been so good that all these things should be coming to him. Of course, I've read on a little bit farther too, so.
Yeah.
Well, he's got a formula for what makes for the perfect life, and he's trying to, you know, run his program, work his formula.
Okay.
And so, variables that he hasn't considered entering into his equation.
Yeah.
Blow the box wide open, is my guess the writing's about to take.
Okay.
Does the whole story go into grace versus, I mean, this kind of self-righteousness that Job had, too? And he covered his bases. In case my daughters might have sinned, I'm going to offer a sacrifice. He covered every base he had.
Wow.
And this guy covered his, too. Is there, I'm asking, I haven't read the story.
What do the rest of you think? Where is this story going? It's a wonderful insight into Job. I actually never made that connection. But you're right, that last line... Cover all your bases. Yeah, make sure, just in case some relative has done something wrong, you'll cover that base too. In order to get what? What you have coming to you? What you should have coming to you. You raised, I'm sorry,
I'm... He feels
he should have coming to him, yeah. You raised a really interesting point. What is it that he wants? Because it's one thing to think that you deserve good. It's another thing to think that you know what good is.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Well, same order, I would be my guess.
Order?
That, you know, he's an insurance salesman, and, you know, the unpredictable is the bane of an insurance person's existence, right?
Yeah.
And so, predictable...
He works for Mutual Life. This is one of the wonderful little prophetic words that gets inserted into this book, right? Because you can read that a lot of different ways. For Raleigh, it means you're covering all your bases. He actually takes out life insurance policies on his irresponsible relatives because they won't do it themselves. They won't do it themselves. Because they're too irresponsible. But he knows they live terrible lifestyles. They're all diabetics. They all eat too much sugar. They're missing limbs. And eventually they roll into early graves, he tells us. He takes out insurance policies on them. He's
and,
that kind of insurance salesman.
And, you
yeah.
know, I worked in an insurance office after seminary before First Call. Mm-hmm. And my job was to pull out all of the exclusions that are not covered.
Huh.
So when you take out homeowners insurance in Oregon, you are not covered for mold and mildew damage. Because we can anticipate that that might happen, and we're not going to pay for it.
Okay.
It was right after September 11th, and now we can anticipate that terrorism or biological weapons could be the cause of destruction. We're not covering that.
Uh-huh.
We were covering it before, and we had to pay out.
Yeah.
We're not covering it anymore. So, I mean, I don't know if the author does that in his insurance scheme or not, but insurance is the game of if you can identify it, you can exclude it.
Right. Okay.
Sorry, apologies.
No, all insurance salesmen, we take it all back. Anybody who is, yeah. But there's an element to that, at least, that there's a sense of security that you get when you buy insurance. I hope I'll never need the insurance that I've taken out on myself. It would seem ridiculous, but I have some. And that gives me a little sense of security. But that idea that this is mutual life, mutual is one thing. If you read that little passage about him in this little Civitans meeting in the Chinese restaurant, he can't wait to leave. He hates everybody at the table except for Fat Mango Sheffield, who's his best friend. And he barely talks to him as he's on his way to meet a couple of clients on the way out the door. So mutual? Well, maybe not. Life? Is that what life is? Cover your bases, make sure that you're in a position to get what you deserve. Have a formula so that you know what the good is that you're going to receive. Life. You've got it covered. Yeah?
This seems like an awful lot of need for control
hmm.
by both Job and this fellow. if you can control life and money and all these situations. I mean, even giving a sacrifice for your children.
Yeah.
I mean, that, like, you're even trying to control God. Not only are you trying to control family and loved ones around you, but you're also trying to control life and God in all this, which perhaps stems on fear.
Interesting. You got to read this book. You all have to read this
book. Is it in the bookstore?
Yeah. Oh, I think I might have just bought the last copy. But I'll say it's in the bookstore, and I'll bet you it will be by the end of the week if you're still here.
There were 3 copies left.
I think I might have bought the last one. It's really fun. It's really fun. And we're getting to a point where we might need to close. Some of you have already read some of these, and we're going to end up having a bell at some point for chapel, and we're going to have to go. But I kind of want to know, since you've only read a little bit of this, what do we want to have happen to this character? And this is part of what I'm thinking about. It even comes up in Mark Twain's piece where he sort of says, I hope you don't know what you're praying for. I think somewhere we know what we're praying for, right? I think somewhere we have at least a little bit of inkling of the reality that we're missing when we're running after those things that we think we deserve. Somewhere out here, the other side of the blinders that we put up, we've got some sense of what life probably should be like. What we might be missing is we're getting on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So we can do this by thinking about the story, I think. What do we want to have happen to Raleigh? What should happen to him before the end of this novel that hasn't already happened to him from what you see in the first chapter?
There's unexpected joys that come up that were never part of the formula that he had
wonderful
prescribed. And so surprises of delight not considered possible.
Yeah. Okay. Unexpected joys. How many joys in your life have really been expected joys? Anybody had one?
Sure.
My first child was born.
But did you know what it was going to feel like?
Of course not.
Okay. That's the thing. Even in those contexts where you think, I've heard this story about when you have your first child, but there's sort of this moment. Nobody's ever told me what it was like. Nobody ever has. There aren't words to describe probably what that is. Joy is unexpected. Joy is a surprise. So, if you spend your whole life constructing these with as many layers, as many fortifying walls as you can, and have God set aside in your garage, in your nice little box life, where's joy? Where's joy? Instead, you get just desserts. But two S's, right? Mm-hmm. Just
deserts.
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 Thank you.
Extra sugar.
I actually was an English major. Believe that. Okay, just desserts, right? Which, let me just suggest this for a second to come back to this problem of judgment. This is not justice. It's not the same thing. This is not what God means when he means justice. And maybe by judgment, this is part of what's happening. Sometimes maybe we need the equivalent, or at least the metaphorical equivalent, of a consuming fire to get rid of these cities that we think we live in, where there's no room for joy, no room for the unexpected. It's a possibility anyway. One way of maybe thinking about judgment. So it's possible if you look at those 2 fortunes that he gets, remember what they are again? You will go completely to pieces by the end of the month, right? And this is your lucky day, right? Judgment and mercy, right? Justice and joy. Same thing, same day, same action. And I really think in this novel, God has to do it. God is one of the primary characters in this book. And I hope you enjoy it, those of you who get a chance to get a copy. Those of you who don't read it, read the first chapter. Enjoy that and then go check out Amazon or whatever else you use it. Any last thoughts before we close? I feel like sending them off to read, but...
I was thinking about the connection with Mai and Tonya.
Uh-huh.
It was a discussion you guys had before.
Was anybody else in that book discussion? Fred was. Doug was.
But one of the closing lines is that life intervened and stopped Jim from returning to Antonia,
that's
like he
right.
promised.
That's right.
And I just think about abundant life intervening, like a different kind of life intervening. That's what I'm hoping for, you know,
yeah.
in this character.
Yeah.
Real life.
Real life.
Joy.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that line, life intervened, right? This is the line to excuse a character in this novel, My Antonia, from not pursuing the woman who he confesses as being the love of his life. Life intervened. Great excuse.
A lot of people have hold of read The Brother's Cape.
Okay.
Mama's strike zone. Mm. Right. Papa explains the strike zone, but she lives in one. It's a box, though.
It's a box. All right. Well, thank you very much. Have a great day.